interim committee on consumer protection, and we're going to start as a subcommittee. We're waiting for a couple more members to be showing up, but due to the time constraints that we have for other events this afternoon, as well as some of the scheduling that some of our members have, I want to go ahead and get started. We're going to start with an informational meeting, and Corey Stressinger is going to be starting off, and this will be dealing with consumer protection issues in general as to some of the issues the executive branch is looking at coming forward. So, Corey, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And if I may, I'd like to have David Tatman, who's the administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, join me at the table.
You bet. But I'd also like to make sure that the microphone's not going to feed back on anything.
How's this?
That sounds fine.
Okay.
Okay, great.
And for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I also want to extend the Governor's appreciation for the opportunity to talk a little about his and our consumer protection agenda. He wasn't able to be here in person, but he did ask me to convey his thanks for the opportunity and also his interest in these issues. And I'm going to talk about several different consumer protection issues. There are some also that I'm not going to cover that you've covered in prior hearings. For example, at your last hearing up in Portland, we talked quite a bit about identity theft, so I don't intend to address that today. And, of course, you've spent quite a bit of time recently on payday lending. And as you know, we will be coming in with some additional proposals, particularly to deal with Internet and out-of-state lenders. But again, unless there's questions, I'm not expecting to address that today. This afternoon, you will also be looking at some issues having to do with construction claims and construction quality, which our insurance and building codes divisions are heavily involved in. But this morning, I'd like to talk about three areas in particular, and those are high-interest consumer loans, check cashing, and medical discount cards. I also want to flag for you a fourth issue, which I'm not intending to get into in any detail, but I do want to mention because it's something you may want to take up at a future meeting, and that's mortgage lending. That is an area where we do get quite a few complaints. The Attorney General gets complaints. And we are going to be having a public forum to hear from consumers and the industry about issues that they see. That is scheduled for Portland on, I believe, the 22nd of this month. Mm-hmm. And attached to my testimony, you'll see our flyer. And you and your constituents are, of course, cordially invited to attend.
Before you go further, just for clarification, when we're talking about mortgage lending, are we talking about like a second on a mortgage or just...
Mr. Chair, no. This is the original mortgage that you would take out when you're purchasing a piece of real estate, or it might be a refinance, or it might be a second mortgage. But we license mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers in this state, and they often use individuals called loan originators to actually deal with the consumer and handle the paperwork. And we that whole area of there are a set of laws, a set of regulations dealing with the standards for disclosure and how consumers should be treated, and so that's the issues that we're looking at.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So if I could, then, on the issue of high-interest consumer loans, it might be useful to start with a little bit of background. If you pull out your ORS and you look up the chapter dealing with interest rates, which is Chapter 82, what you will see is a pretty broad statement that nobody can make a consumer loan for under $50,000 at an interest rate greater than 12% or 5% in excess of the discount rate on a 90-day commercial paper. And you think, oh, well, we have an interest rate cap in this state, but that is subject to a number of exceptions. And if you turn the page, you see the exceptions, and the exceptions essentially swallow the rule. So the exceptions include loans made by banks and credit unions and depository institutions, loans made by pawnbrokers, loans made by commercial or by consumer finance companies, which is what I want to talk about today, mortgage loans, and essentially the pretty much full range of loans that that consumers do get involved in. Consumer finance loans we regulate under ORS Chapter 725, and they are divided into three categories: short-term consumer finance loans, which are payday loans and car title loans, and then what we call conventional consumer finance loans. The short-term loans are 60 days or less. So the conventional consumer finance loans are 60 days or more primarily. And when we at the special session hearing on payday lending, quite a bit of concern was raised. Questions were raised about with the legislation capping interest rates and fees on payday lending, aren't we simply going to see the market shift over to these other loan types and have the same financial structure continue? And that is a concern, and it's a concern of ours. So I want to run through how we propose addressing those concerns. Pawnbroking did come up during that discussion. Pawnbroking is a very old type of lending, and it doesn't get a lot of attention these days, but we do have 47 licensed pawnbrokers in Oregon, and they make loans that are secured by a pledge of goods, and they're fairly tightly regulated about how they handle those goods. And fees and interest rates are already capped by law for pawnbrokers. And, in fact, the caps are the same as those that the legislature has just enacted for payday lending: a setup fee of 10% plus 3% per month, or 36% annually, and that is the same. So pawnbrokers and the new payday lending law actually have the same fee structure. We also heard some concerns that some of this lending activity may shift to car title loans. And car title loans, as I mentioned, are short-term loans of 60 days or less. They're secured by pledge of a title to the borrower's car. We have 96 car title lenders licensed in Oregon, but only one of them is exclusively a car title lender. All of the others also make payday or commercial or conventional consumer loans as well. And currently, there are no caps or limits on fees or interest charged by title lenders, but the legislature has previously authorized DCBS to establish charges and fees by rule. And the governor has asked us to open a rulemaking on that issue, which we are intending to do. And our initial proposal would be to model fees and charges for title loans after the legislatively approved fee structure for pawnbrokers and payday loans, that is 10% origination fee plus 36% APR. But whether this is the right approach or not is, of course, something we would expect to address with our stakeholders during rulemaking, and we will certainly keep you apprised. At the moment, though, we don't expect to propose legislation on car title lending because that statutory authority already exists. So the area where we do expect to propose legislation is that of conventional consumer finance lending. These are consumer loans of up to $50,000, generally loan term of more than 60 days. They could be anything from automobile financing to financing for the purchase of consumer goods or debt consolidation or home equity lines of credit. Some familiar names in this industry are Household Finance, Beneficial Finance, and locally United Financial. Of the 631 consumer lending businesses currently licensed in Oregon, 271 of them have conventional consumer finance licenses. The rest do just short-term lending. Most of the consumer finance companies are national. Many are affiliated with national banks. And these are traditionally amortizing or installment loans, meaning that the borrower will make monthly payments of principal and interest in roughly equal amounts till the loan is paid off. In the past few months in particular, since attention has been focused on payday lending and fees and charges associated with payday lending, we have had a number of inquiries from payday lenders interested in switching over from a short-term payday loan license to a conventional consumer finance license. Many lenders, as I said, already hold both types of licenses. We currently have 17 applications pending from short-term lenders who want to make the switch, and we are now seeing interest rates that are similar to those that we've seen in the payday lending industry, 182%, 200%, 372%. And we've also seen some instances that we regard as quite troubling where the consumer is making interest-only payments, perhaps thinking that they are making that they are paying down the amount of the loan, but in fact, despite the very high monthly payments, at the end of the loan term, they still owe the entire principal amount. Many states do have consumer loan laws that cap interest rates for small consumer loans. Attached to my testimony, you will see a chart detailing those laws in other states. Interest rate caps of 36% APR are very common. According to our research, 29 states have limited the interest rates for these small consumer loans to 36% or less. Only 16 states have no limits. It was interesting to me that in discussing some of these issues with one of our the holders of a conventional consumer finance license whose firm has been in business in Oregon for many, many years, he pointed out that actually in the federal RICO statute, racketeering statute, which has as one of the predicate offenses essentially loan sharking, illegal loans with the threat of violence to collect, one of the factors that can be used to determine whether a loan falls into that category is an interest rate of over 45%. Mm-hmm. So although that's obviously only applies to loans that are illegal, nevertheless it gives some indication of where interest rates break out and where the I guess you might say, shock value of different interest rates fall. We propose that Oregon join the majority of states and cap interest on these small consumer loans. We would propose the same fee structure as we have for payday loans now and for pawnbrokers, 10% origination fee plus 36%, which would put us squarely in the mainstream with other states. As I mentioned, these loans are traditionally fully amortizing. One issue we are thinking about is whether amortization should generally be required for this type of loan to protect the consumer from the unexpected shock of a balloon payment at the end. Pay down requirements are fairly common in other areas. You probably know that for credit cards, which are, of course, national products, federal regulating entity has just increased the required minimum payment amounts so that even credit card debt now is paid off over some length of time. We do understand, though, that there may be some of these types of loans where a balloon payment is appropriate, for example, bridge financing where there is an expected transaction that will generate the cash to pay it off. So we don't have a firm position on that. I raise it simply as an issue that we do expect to be looking at. But we do expect at least to introduce legislation to propose that type of cap on these short-term or these small amount consumer loans. The next area I want to talk about is check cashing, but I'm happy to take questions on this area first if there are any. Okay. Moving on to check cashing then. For someone with a bank account, we never have to think about how we get our paychecks, how we get our money. You can deposit your check in your bank account. You can cash a check. You can write a check. You can get money out of the ATM, and if you're like me and belong to a credit union, you don't pay a fee for the ATM. And really, I don't have to think twice, and you probably don't have to think twice about how to get access to your own money. But if you don't have a bank account, and people may not have bank accounts for a number of reasons, including a shaky financial past, it's actually hard to get your own money. If your paycheck, or perhaps a government welfare check or disability check, the most common way is to use a check cashing store. And currently, fees charged by check cashing stores are not regulated in Oregon. And according to the Oregon Food Bank, over 50% of the households receiving food boxes do not have bank accounts, even though many of them are regularly employed with regular paychecks. Fees for cashing a check can range 5%, 8%, even 10%. 6% is common even for a government check where the risk of a check being dishonored is very low. So ironically, what we are seeing is, in essence, for someone who does not have other ways to cash their check, a slice off the paycheck that they need to live on or a slice off the government benefits that they need to survive. Oregon is currently one of only 17 states that don't regulate check cashing business at all. About half the states do regulate fees, and you'll see some state-by-state comparisons in the material that I provided as well. What we are proposing is a cap of 3% or $5, whichever is greater, for cashing government or payroll checks. That's right in the mainstream of what other states do, and it's also what many businesses do. That is, what we're looking at is best practices for the business model, but we are looking at controlling the costs charged by the outliers. We would propose licensing for the purpose of enforcement, but we would propose exempting from licensing financial institutions like banks and credit unions, and also retailers who cash checks as a customer convenience for no more than 2% or $2. We do recognize that personal checks pose much greater risks than payroll and government checks. We are not proposing to cap the fees on those, although some states do. And we also certainly believe that a check casher should have the right to require ID and to refuse to cash checks that are suspicious. So that is also a proposal that you will be seeing from us.
Question on the payroll checks. How do we distinguish what is a payroll check versus what isn't?
Mr. Chair, generally speaking, a payroll check will have a pay stub attached to it, and we would certainly not have an objection to a check casher requiring that type of evidence.
Okay. Senator Starr, any questions?
My understanding is that you wanted to take some testimony from others on those two areas before we move into the third area that I was planning to discuss.
Yeah, I think to kind of keep everything together so for the record, that'd probably be a good thing to do. And before you walk away, though, let me just see if I thought I had another question. Regarding the part about, in your testimony, you talk about not requiring a license for financial institutions, for banks, credit unions, or other bona fide retailers of cashing checks as a convenience with a limitation of how much they can get. If there's another type of check cashing operation that is already regulated by the department, how would they fit into this? Would they have to have an additional license?
Mr. Chair, many of the consumer finance payday title lending companies also do check cashing.
Mm-hmm.
And we would need, in order for us to know what business they're in and be able to, in the case of complaints, for example, follow up, we would need them to have some type of license. And whether that could be combined with one of the other short-term licenses or whether it would make more sense to have a separate license is something that we're certainly open to discussion about. Many of these businesses do hold several licenses from us now. For example, a payday loan license, a title loan license, and a conventional consumer finance license.
And not knowing what the application is and what the license looks like, I guess the one thing I would hope that you would, let's say, consider and bring back to us as to, I'm going to call it a one-stop license shopping type of mm-hmm. thing, that if you have a business that wants to be involved in multiple types of operations, that maybe there would be application that they would be checking off what they're going to be doing, and they would have a class of license or something like that. That would then, of course, the department would know what they're licensed to do, and it may make it easier for the vendor to be able to get that. And they, of course, always have a way of amending and their current license to be broader or shrinking it if they wanted to modify their business practice.
Mr. Chair, we are enthusiastic about any proposal to reduce paperwork for us and for the businesses, so that is something we definitely should look at, particularly, as I mentioned, since a number of these businesses are already licensed.
Okay, very good. Senator Starr, any questions? All right. Thank you very much. And our next panel is going to be, I believe, Rex Higgin, Angela Martin, Laura Etherton, and Sybil Hibb. And that is one, two, four people, so probably we need to bring one other chair up. And if y'all want to divide it in two or something, we can do that too. Looks like we're covering the chairs. Great. And what I'm going to ask regarding the microphones, the two individuals sitting on this side would use this one mic, and then the other two that way. We'll make sure we get everyone covered and recorded on the tape, and at the same time, maybe not getting a lot of feedback. So I'm not sure if between the four of you, if you've got some type of plan, but we're here to listen. So let y'all start off in whatever order you want to go.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Potanski and members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate for OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. My name's Laura Etherton. And thank you for the opportunity to testify here today regarding the problems that consumers are facing regarding high-interest loans and check cashing fees. Last month, OSPIRG and many others applauded when, during the one-day special session, the Oregon legislature passed a bill that will give consumers new protections from payday loans, previously unlimited interest rates and fees. This action sent an important message that gouging consumers with outrageous interest rates and fees and trapping borrowers in a cycle of debt is something that is unacceptable here in Oregon. Among its provisions, the bill capped interest rates at 36% plus a one-time loan origination fee of $10 per 100. The payday loan industry is one of the largest and most visible industries that charge exceedingly high interest rates, with storefronts appearing on busy street corners and strip malls across the state at an explosive rate over the last decade. And the action that the legislature took last month was a response to this very visible problem. With these reasonable limits on payday lending enacted and due to go into effect in July of 2007, we have an opportunity, indeed, to turn our attention to other areas in the financial marketplace where consumers face exceedingly high interest rates and often outrageous fees. Three such areas that you've heard, but I'd like to address additionally are the areas of car title loans, refund anticipation loans, and the check cashing industry. And for each of these, I'd like just to briefly outline what consumers are facing. The title loan industry is similar to the payday loan industry in that the lenders target consumers who may not be eligible for traditional loans. Title loan companies require the consumer's vehicle title to be placed as collateral for the small loan, and the lender has the power to repossess the borrower's vehicle if they miss a payment. A typical payment agreement for a $400 loan is a minimum monthly payment of $88, none of which is applied to the principal. And this amounts to uncompounded annual percentage rates of over 260%. According to the Consumer Federation of America that has researched this issue fairly extensively, a typical loan is for a maximum of about 20% of the car's value. And lenders often require an extra set of keys to facilitate repossession of the vehicle. Similar to payday loans, the lender has a considerable amount of power to actually get the value of their loan back in this manner. Consumers face not only heavy interest and fees with these loans, but also may pay the very heavy price of losing access to their vehicle should they miss a payment. Another area of growing concern is the refund anticipation loan industry. These are short-term cash advances against the consumer's anticipated income tax refund. And they carry interest rates that vary widely, interest rates from 70% to over 1,800% when all fees and administrative costs are accounted for. The benefit to consumers in these loans is really quite minimal, if any, because consumers can use e-file and receive their tax refund very quickly in 8 to 15 days. In 2004, over 56% of refund anticipation borrowers were earned income credit recipients. In these cases, refund anticipation loans are not only a poor deal for the consumer, they're actually a poor deal for the taxpayer as well, draining away approximately $900 million intended to help working families in poverty in 2004, for example. In 2005, the legislature did take an important first step to address this issue by requiring lenders to at least disclose the loan terms clearly and the fact that it is a loan to borrowers. Finally, I just want to mention a little bit about check cashing. This is another area of growing concern. Whether consumers are away from home or simply do not have a bank account, or cannot afford one, or cannot qualify for one, consumers really shouldn't have to pay exceedingly high fees for access to their own money. Fees as high as 8% are quite high when you consider that that's just access to get your income. For example, for a monthly paycheck of $2,000, that would be a $160 fee. For that worker, typically, that means he'll have to work for about 5 hours just to be able to cash his paycheck. Osberg urges the legislature to closely examine the problems that that consumers are facing across the financial marketplace regarding very high interest rates and fees for financial services and consider enacting strong uniform protections. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I very much appreciate the committee's time and attention focused on these issues. They are of great importance to the low-income clients of the Oregon Law Center. And I'll just briefly describe, in case you're unaware or unfamiliar with the Law Center. We're a nonprofit statewide law firm. We provide free legal assistance to low-income Oregonians in civil matters. Seems like I may still be getting some feedback. Are you?
Yeah,
my voice may be too loud. That right? Let's stay over here. Okay, sorry about that. Just to give you sort of a brief description of the general personality sort of our clients, they're really a broad range of individuals. They are of all ages and of all ethnic backgrounds. They are of, some of them may be facing homelessness, some of them may be victims of domestic violence, some of them may have faced a loss of income because of a layoff recently, some of them may be employed. They have a variety of different characteristics, but the common theme binding them all together is that they're struggling with poverty. And so underlying all of the work that we do with our individual clients on their specific, to help them to address their specific legal needs, we're also trying to help them escape those binds of poverty and to gain the tools and so that they can move forward and have a life in which they can care for themselves and their families and take care of their basic needs. And so that principle is one that brings all of our legal advocates together and binds or brings all of our clients together. And that's sort of why we're here today talking to you about this issue, because we see all too often that the high fees paid by our clients in seeking, for example, to have a check cashed, those sorts of fees that they pay with check cashing in check cashing circumstances or in seeking payday loans or car title loans or other sort of alternative financial services, those fees are very much related to their struggle to escape poverty. And many of our bankruptcy attorneys, we have a pro bono bankruptcy clinic in which private bar attorneys donate their time, and they have said to us that they see these fees playing a great role in their clients eventually needing to seek bankruptcy and other assistance. And so it's very these issues are very much tied to the work that we do. We see these fees driving people further into the cycle of debt, and we think that that doesn't have to be the case. We do recognize that many of our clients may not be able to have or to afford regular banking services, and we recognize that, for example, the check cashing industry provides a valuable service to our clients, many of whom may not be able to seek other services, and some of whom may choose to seek check cashing services. But there's no need for the fees that are charged to be so high as to drive clients further into debt. And in specific, the check cashing industry, or specifically related to the check cashing industry, we have seen, our research has shown that low-income seniors and minority populations are a very high percentage of the clients of this industry. These are vulnerable populations, and the fact that they're driven to pay these high fees makes them have a harder time accumulating assets and establishing a credit history such that they can move out of poverty. Research has shown that in unregulated states, some check cashers have charged fees as high as 21% of a check's value. Again, the bulk of the checks that are being cashed in these by these service providers are either government-issued checks or payroll checks, where the risk is relatively low. And in fact, the Financial Services Centers of America, which is a national trade association for the industry, has indicated that their rate of default is very low. Their rate of the circumstances in which they're unable to cash the checks that are provided to them are very low. The industry is successful in that sense. And so what we're supportive of and what we ask is that a reasonable fee structure be established. And we have no reason to believe that there's a great plethora of service providers in Oregon charging fees as high as 21%. But where that exists, that seems inappropriate. And so reasonable regulation would help to make sure that the service was available, the industry can survive, and the clients are provided with the service, which doesn't drive them further into debt. I wanted to just briefly take a moment to let the committee know about some research which I did, which showed me that in the 33 states where the industry is currently regulated, and in most of those states, as you heard previously, there is a cap established on the fees that can be charged. A study has shown, conducted by the Fannie Mae Foundation in 2003, study showed that across eight urban areas, where some of which had regulations on fee caps or on check cashing fees and some of which did not, there was almost no variation in the per capita existence of service providers. And so this it's reasonable to ask the question whether a regulation will drive an industry out of business, and that's a good question to look at. This study did a very conducted a very thorough research of these eight urban areas and found that there was very little impact on the industry. So we see that the industry is still thriving even though there is the reasonable regulation. So I appreciate the committee's time and effort, and look forward to working with you in the future.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Since your testimony is being handed in, do you have that on electronic form?
I sure do.
Could you send it to our staff? The bottom on both sides, your footnotes did not come through all the way.
I apologize. I'll make sure to take care of that. Thank you, Chair.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Przanski, Senator Starr, apparently I need some water. For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here today representing Our Oregon, a nonprofit coalition working for tax and economic fairness. I'm going to start today thanking you for the steps that you're taking to address the situation thousands of Oregon families face when it comes to decisions that they'll be making around consumer credit and the financial services that they need. The families I'm referring to are primarily low-income households.
Oh, thank you.
Very welcome.
Very nice. These families are primarily from low-income households. Their relationship with mainstream financial service providers ranges from weak to non-existent. I had the opportunity in the 3 years that I worked with Oregon Food Bank to sit down and have conversations with hundreds of these families and ask them in-depth questions about their relationships with financial institutions and how they go about conducting their financial businesses. We know that statewide statistics on the number of unbanked households are limited, but I do want to present you with a few facts that will help us better understand the magnitude. As we've heard others mention, lawmakers took a big step forward in helping cash-strapped families with the passage of the Payday Loan Reform Bill. I thank you, and we thank you for the work of this committee that helped make that very possible. Seeing the intent of this important law carried into practice will require more work and support from our lawmakers. Our Oregon and the members of the coalition who supported payday loan reform encourage you to continue working for improvements. We've heard mention discussion of a statewide database for payday loan transactions. We're certainly in support of that type of improvement. We also feel it's time to take the next step and look at other ways high-cost financial service providers exploit Oregon's low-income families. A report by the General Accounting Office found that in 2002, an estimated 22 million households, or 56 million adults, did not have a bank account. A report on check cashing issued by AARP notes that a recent Federal Reserve survey of consumer finance found that 33% of families headed by persons aged 50 and older do not have a checking account. Similarly, a Brookings Institute study released in 2004 reported that as many as 22% of low-income families, those are families with income under $25,000 a year, do not have a checking account. And then closer to home, we heard mentioned this morning that the latest hunger factor survey conducted by Oregon Food Bank found that 52% of emergency food box recipients, again, do not have a checking account. These families rely on services within the fringe financial market, payday lenders, auto title lenders, and check cashing outlets to gain access to cash and to credit. While these providers offer a convenient service and definitely easy access to cash, the services carry a high cost and diminish the ability of low-income families to accumulate assets and establish financial stability. Check cashers are even undermining one of our country's largest anti-poverty programs, the Earned Income Tax Credit. Last session, this legislature passed an expansion of the program in Oregon because it is a tool for helping families gain financial stability. In 2004, the last year I could find statistics for, more than 200,000 Oregon families received an earned income tax credit. The federal value of that credit was $350 million coming to Oregon families. Every penny of that $350 million should have gone into the budgets of these families to help them pay their rent, to help them keep their electricity on, buy groceries, fill up their tank with gas, or even put some aside for emergencies. Unfortunately, for too many of these families, a big chunk of that money is going to cash their checks instead of into their family budgets. Here's how it works. The EITC refund checks come as a tax refund from the state and or the federal government. This is a guaranteed check, and there is no danger it will bounce. Yet, fees in Oregon range from 2% to a high of 10% to cash all types of checks. So on a on an earned income tax credit check at 4.5%, that $1,000 EITC refund is going to cost that family $45. No risk for the owner. It's money in their pocket. But for the check casher and the tight economy, it's money clearly down the drain. Over the course of the year, these fees charged for fringe financial services add up. Again, I look at a Brookings Institute study released in 2002, which estimates that households with an annual income of $18,000 a year can spend $400 a year on these types of services. Another study estimates that over a lifetime, check cashing services will cost seven times more than a basic checking account. We can give a lift to low-income and moderate-income households who use these services and help more hardworking families keep money in their pockets by joining the majority of states that regulate and cap fees that check cashers charge. I end by thanking you again for the opportunity to testify. I look forward to the opportunity to work with the members of this committee on curbing further high-cost financial services. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hagan.
Yes. I think it's going to work from here. I have a fairly loud voice. Chair Prasansky, Senator Starr, thank you very much for holding this meeting and for allowing me to speak. For the record, my name is Rex Hagans. I'm a member of the Prince of Life Lutheran Church in Oregon City and Vice Chair of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon's Public Policy Committee. I speak to you today as a representative of the faith community, a community that is both saddened and angered by the continuing exploitation of the poor by fringe financial practices in this state. We see increasing numbers of Oregon citizens today literally tangled in a web of flawed political and social structures that leave them ensnared and unable to escape. While wages stagnate and even decrease in real terms, more and more families, even those with two wage earners, find they cannot stretch incomes to cover the basic necessities or cover even the slightest emergency. And as sources of emergency relief funds are dried up by cuts in long-standing programs of assistance, the web tightens its final grip on those already deeply impoverished. They turn in desperation to unscrupulous lenders, rapidly incur debts in which they never can hope to pay. All hope is now gone. In such a context, consumer protection seems to us to assume a much greater significance than we have traditionally attached to it. To paraphrase a well-known metaphor, consumer protection is increasingly the thin blue line standing between thousands of Oregonians and a lifetime of personal despair and ruin. You and your colleagues took a significant step forward in strengthening that line with the passage of payday loan reform in the recent special session. But as you've heard here today, there's much more that needs to be done. Other outrageous lending practices continue to threaten the well-being of our most vulnerable citizens. In the view of many in the faith community, this raises serious issues of public morality. The presiding bishop of my own church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, speaking about the role of morality in public policymaking, said recently, "We believe the very core of our faith, the Holy Scriptures, widens the lens of morality from simply looking on the morality of individuals to examining the morality of ourselves as a people, as a nation. And that morality in the light of the Scriptures will be tested finally on the condition of the poor among us." Certainly that goes for the state of Oregon as well. I urge you to continue on the path we began to take with the passage of payday loan reform and do what we all know is the right thing. Give us law and regulation that reins in other outrageous practices that prey on those least able to protect themselves. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you. Questions? I have a couple that I just want to see. I guess this may be for Ms. Martin, based on your work previously with the Oregon Food Bank. Mm-hmm. On that survey that was done, was there any reasons that the individuals gave as to why they chose not to have checking accounts?
Pardon me. On that survey, it's simply a survey tool. People go out and fill out thousands of, I think it's a five-page survey. So they don't offer many reasons there. The more context is given in the focus groups that we would do. So when I would sit down in our focus group reports, we have 3 years of them where we discuss their relationship with financial institutions. The reasons ranged from feeling like they didn't have enough money to start a checking account, so some misconceptions about what it takes to start a relationship with a bank. Some folks had had checking accounts before and ran into trouble and were no longer eligible. I even met folks who have checking accounts, but it took me forever to understand the process that some folks would go through. They have a checking account, but because of the lack of float time that you get on writing your checks anymore or making your payments, and they're such low balance customers that there's a float time on their deposit. So when they put money into the bank holds it for 3 days. But the money coming out does not have that 3-day grace period. So folks would take their checks to a check casher, cash it, and then put it in the bank. So it's a complicated mix of what's happening for people and why they choose to use these services or feel that these services are their only option.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Someone does. You need a little more perspective. And I think the other question I had would be probably for Ms. Etherton was the issue on the title loans. You're saying that that some lenders require keys to the vehicles to be kept as part of the collateral besides the title?
That's correct.
Okay. Has there been any, have you done much research on that as to how that actually has panned out? Has anyone ever complained about keys, let's say, being lost by the vendors or anyone, let's say, taking the car inappropriately?
Chair Pozanski and Senator Starr, not that I am aware of, but it is certainly a security concern. And again, that requiring copy of the keys is a frequent practice as a basic term of the agreement.
Okay.
In many states.
Yes.
Chair Pozanski, thank you again, Sybil Hebb. Just to add to that, I did discover that we've recently had a case in which two low-income individuals sought the assistance of a title loan for two of their vehicles, the primary vehicles, both the husband and the wife in this family, and they made their payments and were completely paid off, but were having a great deal of difficulty getting the titles returned to them. That case is still under investigation. It's not resolved yet. But so there has been that issue presented to us.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other thoughts? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And I think we're going to have Horace Messenger come back up and pick up on the medical discount cards. And if you had someone, I also had Alan Ehrenbaum. I'm not sure if they're supposed to come up at the same time or they're separate.
I think following each other.
Okay. Corey?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'd like to shift gears away from the financial services industry next and talk a little about an aspect of the healthcare industry that's come to our attention recently. And, of course, there are a great many issues that we're involved in, that you're involved in, that the governor's involved in, relating to affordability and availability of health care and health insurance and cost transparency in health insurance. I'm not proposing to address that whole spectrum here today, but I do want to address one specific consumer protection issue, and that has to do with a product generally known as medical discount cards. And you may... have received over your fax machine a flyer at some point that says, protect your family, $49 a month, $89 a month, no pre-existing conditions, doctors, hospitals, vision, care. There's actually some examples attached to my testimony of what those flyers tend to look like. Sometimes you get a phone call trying to sell this product. And those sound like pretty good prices for health insurance, but this is not health insurance. A medical discount cards charge a fee for, usually a fee for enrollment, and then a monthly charge. And what they entitle you to is a discount on your medical care expenses from providers who participate in a network that the card company has negotiated with. And so in some cases, they can be a very good deal and a good financial decision for someone. If, you, for example, you have high prescription drug costs and you do not have prescription drug coverage in your health insurance, and one of these card companies may have negotiated a range of discounts with the providers, the pharmacies that you deal with, then paying that monthly fee may end up, in fact, substantially reducing your drug costs. Some of the cards cover vision or dental services that traditional health insurance doesn't always cover. However, some of the products do have significant problems. They can range from lack of accurate disclosure. That is, sometimes they are marketed as health insurance or using words that make the buyer think that they are insurance. In fact, if you have one of these cards, you do not have insurance. You remain personally responsible for all of your health care costs and all of your health care bills. You may get a discount, but the costs are yours to pay, as opposed to an insurance product where the risk is actually transferred and it's the insurance company's responsibility to pay their costs. So, for example, you may have a major health issue, you may be hospitalized, and you may then be surprised to find that those bills are your responsibility and you do not, in fact, have the coverage that you think you have. So that is one area of marketing where the person thinks they're buying insurance, but in fact they're not. There are also instances where it turns out that the provider network is such that it is not, it provides no value at all to the consumer. We've had instances where consumers from rural areas, for example, find to their dismay that the only providers are located far from their homes in the Portland metropolitan area. Sometimes the products are actually fraudulent. That is, the provider network doesn't exist. The consumer is provided with a list of doctors, hospitals, et cetera, who are purportedly willing to accept the card and give a discount, but when they show up at the doctor's door, the doctor has never heard of the company and the discount is not forthcoming. In many cases, the financial arrangements, in order to get the card, you authorize a automatic electronic transfer out of your bank account for the upfront fee, which could be anywhere from $100 to $500, and then also the monthly fee. And we have had consumers who find out that the product is valueless to them and then have great difficulty canceling that electronic funds transfer. In some instances, in fact, we've had people whose only recourse was to actually close their bank account to stop the transfers. And, of course, they find themselves unable to get refunds. So this is an area that we are starting to see here. In some other states, the problems have been more widespread. We do believe that these products can provide value, and we're not in any way proposing to ban them, nor are we proposing that they be subject to the full range of regulation that insurance products are. But we do think that consumers, number one, should know what they're buying, and number two, should be protected against the fraudulent products that are sometimes being sold today. So we do intend to propose legislation to address this type of product. In our legislation, we expect to propose registration with our insurance division so that what's been the case in other states is that a registration requirement is a good way of screening out the products that are truly fraudulent. In addition, we would like these plans to be required to provide specific information to the buyers about the provider network and the discounts. And we also strongly suggest a 30-day free look period so that the buyer has an opportunity, if they respond to one of these high pressure sales tactics, to actually see what they're getting, what the provider list looks like, what the discounts look like, and then if it turns out that it's not going to have value to them, to cancel the product and get a refund. And then finally, we do believe that we're going to need some oversight over the advertising materials to ensure that the advertisements don't use insurance-like terminology and that they clearly state that the product is not health insurance. So that you will be seeing proposed legislation from us along those lines. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I believe you also have attached to my testimony, in addition to those advertisements, we've given you a sort of summary of what we're seeing in the industry, and I believe you have also here somebody from the medical discount card industry to testify about what they see and what their suggestions are. Happy to answer any questions.
None for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I believe our next speaker is Alan Ehrenbaum.
Good morning, Chair Prasansky and members of the committee. My name is Alan Ehrenbaum. I'm an attorney in Los Angeles, and I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the Consumer Health Alliance, which is the National Trade Association of the Discount Healthcare Companies. I want to take a few minutes to talk with you about the discount healthcare industry, about the Consumer Health Alliance, and about our views regarding how to develop targeted and practical legislation to regulate our industry. And after listening to the director speak, I think you'll hear a lot of similarities in my comments to hers. Discount healthcare programs are non-insurance programs, and I do have written testimony, I'm sorry, that I submitted, and I'm going to be delivering a somewhat shorter version of what you have in writing. Discount healthcare programs are non-insurance programs which offer consumers direct access to healthcare products and services at discounted rates. Discount healthcare programs are offered not just by discount companies to the public, but by insurance companies to their subscribers, banks to their customers, and nonprofit organizations to their members. The simplicity and value of these programs are enjoyed by millions of people in every state in the country. Our member companies have about 300,000 participants in Oregon today. Discount healthcare programs began operating about 15 years ago, primarily to offer access at discounted rates to ancillary healthcare services not typically covered by insurance plans. These services often included dental, pharmacy, vision, chiropractic, and hearing. Legitimate discount healthcare companies have always made clear that the access they provide to these discounts is not insurance. In recent years, the skyrocketing cost of healthcare has made traditional health insurance increasingly unaffordable. This instability in the market has created an opportunity for some bad actors to exploit unwitting consumers through discount healthcare schemes that promise a lot and deliver little or nothing. Leading discount healthcare programs became concerned that these bad actors were going to define the industry in the minds of consumers and regulators. In order to ensure that this did not happen and to protect consumers' access to legitimate discount healthcare programs, these companies joined together to form the Consumer Health Alliance, or CHA. CHA's mission is threefold. First, to educate consumers and regulators about the consumer benefits of quality discount healthcare programs, and to give consumers the information they need to find a reputable program. Second, to create a code of conduct which establishes benchmarks for well-operated consumer-friendly programs. And third, to work with state legislatures and regulators to develop laws and regulations that provide appropriate consumer information and protection, create tools to shut down fraudulent companies, and allow legitimate companies to continue to provide access to affordable health care without unnecessary burdens. About half of all states now have specific legislation addressing discount health care programs, including Oregon, which enacted a law dealing with prescription drug discount programs in 1999. In order for state legislation to be effective, CHA believes it must achieve two primary goals. First, it must be targeted. The legislation must clearly and specifically address the key discrete problems that have emerged with respect to some discount programs, namely fraudulent or misleading advertising, fly-by-night companies, and inadequate consumer protections. At the same time, it should not unnecessarily hinder the operations of legitimate companies. Second, it should be practical. The legislation must recognize that because discount healthcare programs are not insurance, they should not be regulated as insurance. The regulatory responsibilities placed on the insurance division by the legislation should be at a level that the state can reasonably be expected to handle and companies can reasonably be expected to comply with. With these goals in mind, CHA believes that legislation should contain the following five basic components. First, registration. A focused registration scheme would allow the state to obtain basic information about the discount healthcare companies operating in Oregon, allowing the state to go after problematic or unregistered companies. Just as importantly, the state could give consumers information about which programs are registered, thereby reducing the number of consumers who enroll in fraudulent programs. Second, disclosures. Disclosures ensure that consumers understand what their program is and what it is not. The most important disclosure is that the program is not insurance. In addition, the discount program should disclose that discounts are available only at participating providers and that members will be responsible for paying the entire discounted rate at the point of service. Third, the operational requirements. Discount healthcare programs should be required to operate in a consumer-friendly manner. The discount program should provide consumers with a toll-free number and a website to find participating providers and get answers to questions about the program before they enroll. Consumers should be able to cancel their memberships within 30 days and get a refund of membership fees, but not a nominal one-time administrative fee. The discount program should also be prohibited from any advertising that is false, misleading, or deceptive, and should approve in writing all advertising of its program used by marketing entities. Fourth, provider agreements. A fundamental element of every discount program is that the providers listed in conjunction with the card must be contracted to participate in the program and provide the discounts. Where the contracts are with networks, as is typically the case, the networks must be authorized to contract with the discount programs on behalf of their providers. Finally, remedies. Basic remedies should be available to the state to enforce the discount program registration. These remedies should include the right to revoke, suspend, or condition a program's registration and thus affect its ability to operate in the state. In conclusion, CHA appreciates the opportunity to testify today and looks forward to working with the department and the legislature to develop legislation which provides strong protections for consumers while allowing legitimate discount healthcare programs to continue providing access to affordable healthcare services to hundreds of thousands of Oregonians. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being here and giving us your testimony. Any questions? Thank you. So here's Corey, if you'll come back up, I think you're going to give us an overview, maybe some other consumer protection issues that the department's looking at.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I have one question for Corey.
Okay.
It's back on the medical discount card situation. How many complaints have you gotten?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, let me take a quick look. And I don't think I brought that part of my file. And I see Cindy Jones was just about to walk out the door and come back.
Didn't quite get out the door.
This is Cindy Jones from our insurance division. Let's have her answer your question instead.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Jones with the insurance division, and I didn't hear it because I was on my way out the door.
We have... let me just restate. We have testimony from Director Streisinger that there's been significant numbers of consumer inquiries and complaints regarding medical discount cards over the past several years. I just want to know how many.
I show 215 for the year 2004, 92 for 2005, and then from January to this year, there were 17.
And is that complaints or inquiries?
Those are complaints, written complaints.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And, Mr. Chair, I think I may have already covered the other topics just briefly in my introductory remarks.
Okay.
That I wasn't planning to testify about in detail, the identity theft issues and the mortgage lending issues. So I'm happy to address those in more detail if you like, but otherwise I think they've been covered.
That one's going to go away. That means the microphone.
Thank you.
Did you have any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Well, we're running ahead of schedule, and I do see Mr. Long is here. Mr. Smith? Yes, there he is. So I'm going to go ahead and say, let me ask this. I think what we'll do before we go into that, we have scheduled public hearing, and we'll go ahead and have public hearing after we complete the next section. But there are some people here, based on the first informational meeting topic of consumer protection issues and discussions. Is there anyone here that would want to give public testimony regarding that area? If there is, let's go ahead and just do that now since we've got some time. I wasn't sure how much time we're going to need for the informational part. Not seeing anyone raising their hand, running up to the podium, I guess we'll move into the next topic. Consumer contractors issue discussion. This is more kind of a follow-up on some stuff that the committee had in, I believe, our first meeting. And so I'm going to ask Mr. Smith and Mr. Long if you both would come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes and Project Manager for the Task Force. And I know Craig is here and wants to introduce himself and talk to you about a few things CCB's done, and then we'll go right into the Task Force, if you don't mind.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Chair Prochansky and Senator Starr, Craig Smith is my name. I'm Administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and we're on your agenda today to give you a quick update of where we have been the last 4 months, what we've done, and some information about the Task Force on Construction Claims. I'm here to report to you that we continue to work on our website. The website has dramatically improved over the course of the last 4 months. We introduced that to you in January. I think we've got most of the bugs worked out. I can tell that the complaints have gone down regarding the bugs. Interestingly, we have introduced a new wrinkle to that website, which is a reduced format version. It allows a person to check on a contractor's license on those cellular phone devices. I don't use those, but I understand others do. Mark happens to have one, and what you can do with this now is if you don't have a hard line or a Wi-Fi connection to a computer and you're out in the field, you can use your cellular phone and get the state's information about whether or not a contractor is currently licensed as of that second by using that technology. So we find that that may add to our ability to enforce the law and provide some service to the public. We've also passed some rules that allow us to increase bond requirements for contractors who have proven to be at risk to the public. We look for additional statutory authority in that regard. We're working on legislative concepts that will be before you, will bring before you, that will increase contractor accountability, provide additional protections for consumers. And we're looking for some additional tools that will allow us to use our enforcement program a little bit more robustly. We also have been continued to work with the Task Force on Construction Claims, and with your permission, we'll turn it over to Mark and we'll go through those.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Good morning again, Mr. Chair. Hopefully you have some handout materials I provided for you, kind of reflecting since January when we were here last. We kind of talked about the Task Force, and we were in the process of gathering testimony from a variety of folks. We have about 300 individuals signed up to the task force website that we've created just for monitoring the activities of the task force. There's been about 250 documents submitted. We've had six or seven meetings. Since January, we've had two additional task force meetings where we've really taken the 50 to 60 different specific recommendations and narrowed those down to 10 concepts. And I provided you kind of an overview of those in the packet materials. And I'll just touch on those briefly. And we're also going to kind of walk through with you where we're at and where we think we're going, if you have just a moment. Also, I provided to you just the schedule of events, background information, anybody. And we've made these materials available on the out front. You can get on our website. You can track what we're doing. We want to have a lot of public input. We're about ready to wrap up phase one. If you look at this document, which is really looking at the construction defect issues, we have a meeting coming on May 24th. And then we're going to start looking at some of the insurance availability and coverage issues. We figure that's going to be three or four meetings, and then we'll start getting into the report writing phase. And we have plenty of opportunity within each of those meetings for public comment and input. When we look at the concepts, this list of 10, this is what the task force is currently reviewing right now. And in February and in April, the task force spent deliberative time looking at these individually, and I expect in May they will be making specific recommendations for us to go on and do drafting, if you will, similar to your process here at the committee level. When you get to it, they're going to authorize us to begin, if you will, the legislative council side of this equation, and begin writing the concepts and then bringing it back for final committee approval and then hopefully subsequent submittal into the report that will come to you. I've taken those 10 concepts, Craig and I have, and put them into this document we call a framework for change, so that anyone, whether this body or the task force or the public, can kind of see where those concepts fit into the overall change that could occur, all this, and then what are the areas they attempt to strengthen. And we've broken it up into areas of consumer information, and we're going to talk to you in detail about that, standards, which are the building code standards, the design, the impacts to the design and architectural community, impacts to the workforce. Those are the additional requirements on the contractors, what they would need to do. Things that occur at the construction site that would be new if all of this was to go forward. The enforcement tools, and then what we call post-construction or maintenance issues and how we're looking at that. So it's kind of a broad-based approach to looking at this issue of construction defects and claims. What I'd like to do is just kind of highlight several of these key areas and walk through this framework document, because we think that it hopefully provides a pretty clear picture of some of the issues we're wrestling with. And I know that, Craig, that you will start off. You've mentioned some of your consumer information, but go ahead and touch on some of those bullets, and then I'll pick up some of the other pieces.
Well, as we talked earlier, one of the most important things is to provide information to consumers, so consumers have the tools necessary to protect their interests. Obviously, the state's website, whether they be over at the Department of Consumer Business Services or Construction Contractors Board, if they're designed appropriately, can provide important information to consumers. We've been working on that, as you know, over the last several months, really about 10 months. And at this point, we have a revised consumer page that provides information on the best practices for hiring a contractor. What does licensed and bonded actually mean? I think we learned that there may be a misconception about what those terms provide in terms of protections for consumers, and consumers need to understand precisely what it does. Also, terms that should be in a contract. What an arbitration clause is. So many contracts today have those arbitration clauses, and we find from time to time that consumers, after they've signed a contract and had a problem with the contractor, then determine that they have an arbitration clause which they really would prefer not to live with, but of course it's in the contract and they're required to. Construction liens, what are they? How do they work? Why do they exist? What are the ways to protect your interests from construction liens is in the webpage. What should I do if I have a problem with a contractor? Top five problems for consumers, and then there's additional information that we put in that consumer page that we're trying to market to consumers. Currently, the website shows the full last 7 years' history for all of the contractors that are listed there. And, of course, we've got written publications. Not everybody uses the website. We need to be able to talk to people on the phone as well as to mail them materials. At the Task Force on Construction Claims last meeting, I explained to the Task Force 7 products that we have for consumers that we've written over the last 25 years. They include 16 ways to avoid remodeling and repair problems, how to avoid being the victim of construction fraud, a consumer's checklist so that when you're in the business of trying to consider a home improvement, what are the things you can do from top to bottom to secure your interests, acting as your own contractor. You know, it's very attractive, particularly when you reach my age, to perhaps be your own contractor. And at the Construction Contractors Board, we see families divided We see hearts broken when persons have tried to build their own home, use subcontractors, some licensed, some not. The whole project goes into a disrepair, and of course it ends up on our desk trying to unscramble it. So a person can act as their own general contractor, but we provide some hints about how to do that and do that right if that's going to be a person's choice. We have publications aimed at manufactured dwelling home repair. That's a specialty that we've seen some problems with. And of course, we have some of the more elderly individuals that live in these homes that need to have special attention. We have a document called 10 Risky Home Improvement Shortcuts. These are shortcuts that sometimes consumers take in an effort to save a penny, and it ends up costing them a pound. And we'd like to let them know ways that they can protect against that. And then looking for a home inspector. Those are among the documents that we have out and available. We're currently revising those. We revise them, it seems like, every year, trying to make them more interesting and more informative. Because the thing that we've discovered is we can have the best information available. If the public doesn't take access to it or doesn't choose to read it, it's virtually worthless to them. So the important thing is to get the information into the head of the consumer. And we use our website. We use home shows, we use speeches, and we use a variety of other techniques, including written material, to try to get that message out. A couple of the other things that we're looking at, you may find before you later on in the session, would be a legislative concept that might allow the Construction Contractors Board to set minimum standards for a construction contract. It's a controversial issue. Many times folks don't want the state involved in saying what can or should be in a contract, but we've seen some pretty difficult contracts in our day. Contracts handwritten that are not legible, copies that are left for consumers that are not legible, print so small that the consumer couldn't read it. Things like this perhaps could be addressed by some minimum standards. You currently have passed statutes that require construction contracts in excess of $2,000 to be written, but unlike in the landscape industry, in the construction industry, we don't have authority to set any standards. We think there may be some gold to be mined there. There also seems to be a bit of a contest on both sides of this equation to write the perfect contract that protects the interest of whoever you happen to be on. That escalating issue, it probably isn't the most healthy thing to see in the marketplace. What I mean by that is a contract that perfectly takes care of the contractor is not necessarily good for the consumer, and one that perfectly takes care of the consumer may not be good for the contractor. So who's out there trying to write a contract that would be in the middle of the road, that would be perhaps a model contract? We'd like authority for the Contractors Board to wade into this arena, perhaps publish a contract example that either side could use if they choose to, would not be required, but would be aimed at trying to balance the interests of both sides. Today, there's nothing like that out there, and of course, most of the time, the contracts are written by the contractors. So we'd like the authority to do that.
Mr. Smith?
Yes, sir.
Do you think you need authority from the legislature to do that at this stage?
Chair Brzezinski, I don't know that we would need authority. We probably could do that without authority. I would certainly like the blessing of the Assembly. I'd like to bring it up. And we don't have it specifically today. I think we would have authority to publish anything we wanted to.
Right.
I would certainly like to have the Assembly's suggestion that that's a good idea for this agency to do.
Okay.
I think what I'll do, Mr. Chair, is kind of walk through you this list of concepts and talk to you about the things the task force is considering and the ones that probably would require legislative attention,
okay,
should they make it to the final cut list, and kind of give you a sense of some of the issues that you would expect to see. So if you...
And Mr. Long, before you do that, you say make the final cut list of what the task force,
yes,
is going to recommend.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, obviously I don't want to get too far in front of my task force in that they haven't made their final recommendations to us in May, which I suspect they will, and then final document later this fall. But this is what's under review, serious review at this point. And so if I give you kind of a sense of if these things were to move forward, they would probably end up with you or someone over here at the, in the legislative body.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So if you look at the first concept, which is really looking at the Construction Contractors Board enforcement powers, there are three different options there. One of them, I'm going to look at the bottom one, would be providing the ability for the CCB to prosecute criminal, provide citations or misdemeanor. Obviously, I think that that takes some legislative review, and I'm not sure if that's going to make the final cut list, but it is under review. Preventing problem contractors from obtaining a license under a new corporate identity, that's kind of getting at the revolving door where somebody changes their name. Those kind of things look like they might need some legislative attention. And then option number 1A, increasing CCB's enforcement powers, including terminated contractors' license within the history. There's really this whole issue of looking at immediate suspensions versus the standards process that you go through where you provide notice, you go to contested case, and then you take action. The question is there a point to where you want to immediately suspend and then pending a hearing and then go from there? And that's really an issue that we'll be looking at the division, and I know that CCB is looking at as well, so that you can get at these really egregious acts. Under concept number 2, building envelope contractor licensing, Craig, I believe that that would take some kind of legislation, as I recall. This is really looking at providing some competency standards for the contractors themselves, specific to the areas of envelope construction where we're seeing a lot of moisture problems and those kinds of things, siding, roofing, windows, doors, flashing, etc., that kind of area. What kinds of competency standards? And I think that that would change Craig's statutory framework. Recovery fund is an issue that many folks are interested in, and I believe that that is something that the CCB board is as well looking at, and the task force is looking at, and that would require legislative action. And that is some kind of mechanism for if the bond is exceeded, you know, how do you provide a recovery to consumers, and really looking at residential versus commercial or all contractors. Craig talked to you about contractor bonding. You've done some administrative things. You're also looking at some legislative pieces. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that what we're talking about there is the bond for a general contractor today is $15,000. You've heard me and heard from others that might suggest that doubling or tripling that bond may have some unintended consequences that would be difficult to live with. But certainly it hasn't increased over the last 7 years. And there's been inflation, the cost of materials and land, of course, has gone through the roof since then. So an increase of $5,000 perhaps may be warranted, and you'll see legislation to that effect.
Then the last concepts, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, depending on what the task force does, may or may not need legislative approval to implement those. It depends on how far we go, and I just don't know yet, Mr. Chair. But the building code amendments, most of those can be taken care of through an administrative process. Best practice guidelines can be taken care of through an administrative process unless we're asking for more information from the architect and design community, then we might need to come back and look at changes to their laws. Quality control measures, a lot of that can be done administratively. Some of it may need to be legislative if we actually require third-party verification, which would be a new program, and or additional oversight by some kind of third-party or engineer-architect entity. That would probably require legislation. Residential permits, those would be an administrative area. Consumer education related to maintenance, again, if it was on the information side, that's administrative. If it became some kind of requirement with required follow-up inspections, those kinds of things, then that would be something that would come to the legislature. And then, as you know, training can be voluntary or it can be mandated, and that goes a variety of different ways. So that's kind of the range of issues in front of the task force, kind of looking at increasing the CCB's enforcement powers, looking at contractor licensing or competency, recovery fund, bonding, and then these building codes, quality control, and oversight measures. Again, we've incorporated those all into a document that kind of lists the things that we're doing by ourselves as the agencies, as well as where the specific concept would fit in, and which is the group that's impacted, whether it's on the consumer notice side. This kind of looks at the sequencing of construction. You try to do the work up front, provide information, you get your codes, you get your design correct, you get your workforce trained properly, you do some things on site, and then, of course, if you have to, you take some enforcement actions, and there's post-construction issues with maintenance and warranties and those kinds of issues. So that's where we're at. I'm pleased with the progress of the task force and looking forward to getting greater clarity on some of these specifics so that staff can then begin writing the actual documents and providing an update to you on which of these would require legislative assistance.
Okay, great. And so on the framework for the changes and the concepts, that would be the committee or the task force will be making their final cuts as you described them at what point?
Well, Mr. Chair, on the May 24th meeting, if you look at my overview document that talks about the claims task force and on the back of it is the list, on the May 24th meeting, what I expect to have is to look at these various list of concepts, and you see there's options within each one, getting votes that would say we approve, and I'm just making this up, option 3A to go to further drafting. And that tells us kind of where the committee is at that point. And then what's going to happen is staff is going to come back and really put the details on that concept and look at, is it administrative, is it legislative, what would it look like, how would it work, and then incorporate that in the report. We'll bring those back to the task force through the course of their next meetings to get their buy-off as we get them completed. So there will be some brought back in June, July, August, and then we're really going to wrap it up in September, October. So.
Okay. And I don't know if you provided to us in the January meeting, I just don't remember, a list of those individuals that are actually make up the task force.
I don't know that I did, but I certainly can.
I'd like to have that with the variation as to where they are within this process. I mean, are they part of the industry, part of the regulators, or whoever they may be there in what capacity?
Sure. Be happy to do that.
That'd be wonderful.
They're laid out in the bill, and there are specific slots that people fill. I'd be happy to do that.
So you can tell us, or tell me which ones are filling which slots, so I'll just know
exactly
where that's at.
Yeah, and then, Mr. Chair, after the May meeting, I'll have a pretty good sense where the task force members are standing on a particular issue. It's basically been a process of gathering information. Huge amount of information, 250 documents, 60 recommendations, synthesizing those down to some concepts, and now we're kind of getting into, all right, here's where I'm at, and asking staff to go off and complete that work.
And what I'll say is, looking at what you presented today, as this update is wonderful, just seeing how much work has gone in, clearly it looks like the task force has been looking at multiple concepts as well as means of helping maybe make both the department and the board a little bit more functioning as to the needs of all individuals in the state.
Yeah, it's been a good process, and we're working very closely with the board, and as a matter of fact, many of the issues they're looking at, the task force is looking as well, and bringing those together.
Great.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. There's a couple other individuals that are scheduled to come to give public testimony based on the scheduling that we had set forth. Some of them thought that we would not be taking that testimony until later. What I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to go ahead and open it up now, and let's go ahead and take the testimony of those who are here. And I am going to limit testimony to the point of where we're covering the topics of what we've covered today in the informational meeting. And then what we'll probably do is stand at ease and reconvene to take any other testimony. So, Mr. Varco, I know you're here. Is there anyone else that's here currently that wanted to give testimony besides Mr. Varco? Mr. Varco, come on up.
Good morning.
Good morning. And let me be, Mr. Markle, before you get started, let me just, I'm not sure how long you've been here as to what you, if you heard the testimony regarding the information that's presented to the committee today or not.
I must apologize. My scheduling didn't allow me to get here until moments ago.
Okay, that's fine. So basically what we did, just to give you a snapshot, that's what I'm going to kind of ask you to focus your testimony on, is what is happening with the Construction Claims Task Force as to what they're proposing. If you're not familiar with, I assume you've been following their work. We've received handouts. One is called a Framework for Change, showing seven different areas of what they are looking at. There's a set of concepts that have been distributed to the committee as to what the task force is going to continue to be looking at. And CCB has also just gave us a little update as to how some of the changes they discussed during the January meeting, how that's taking place. So with that, I see that you've got a written testimony. Why don't you go ahead and give us an overview of what you wanted to talk about. It's not necessary to read this word for word.
Thank you. Actually, I came here prepared largely today to discuss some issues that through a miscommunication was not able to discuss at the first meeting regarding the BCD, the DCBS, and to some degree the CCB. I did not come here today prepared to discuss the task force itself other than to say I and a lot of other folks have concerns about the task force in that it was sponsored by a building industry group. I believe there's a lot of cooperation between that group and the DCBS in selecting the task force and determining what it's going to do. There's concerns that the task force may be just a tool to accomplish what some folks in the building industry want to accomplish. They failed at the last legislative session to achieve tort reform to further restrict what precious few rights homeowners have now, and I'm concerned that they may try to take another run at it with new information or whatever may come out of this task force.
Well, let me just say, there's a whole bunch of, speculation of what might occur in the future.
Sure.
From an industry perspective in any given area. That day will come sometime in the future, and we'll discuss those things at that time. I would, suggest that you get a list of the concepts that are part of the public testimony today, and you can review those, and then I expect that we will have a follow-up meeting. I think our next meeting is in August, if I'm not mistaken, and that's probably where we're going to be having some more public forum at that point. And I know I personally will be working with the individuals of both the board and the task force as to what, as they're going through this process. They have a meeting on the 24th of this month, and after that time, kind of getting a snapshot of where some of the options might be and where they're going. So there will be some other checks and balances in the system. So
very good.
Why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, and we're going to go ahead and stand down after that.
Actually, the bulk of this involved the BCD, and if that's not a topic of concerns about that organization, so if that's not a topic, then I believe I'm finished for the moment.
Well, when you say the bulk of it was for who, don't use the acronym.
Oh, Building Codes Division.
All right. And, I mean, Building Code Division is here. I mean, they did give some testimony. So if, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, what I don't want to do is go through the your particular situation and all the issues that we've already discussed. And so what I need is, I guess, if there's some overview of some issues regarding the division, that you want us to be aware of that you have not already covered, then I need that. If not, then we appreciate you handing this in, and then I'll make sure that all of the committee members receive it and move forward.
Well, I'll just try without even referencing my document here to cover the gist of the concerns that I and others have with the BCD, and that this is an organization charged by statute to be protecting the public, to be, you know, implementing and enforcing the building code throughout the state. It appears that what they actually do is to cater heavily to the desires of the building industry. An example of that is there's a national building code that is largely adopted in Oregon. However, it's my understanding in Oregon that we have taken that code and watered it down in regards to specific seismic issues. An example is a plate washer that's used to hold a house down to its foundation. The national code requires a fairly large, heavy washer, and in Oregon, for it's my understanding, for whatever reasons, and I can only assume it's under pressure from the building industry because it's saving 50 cents or so per washer, they've allowed a small flat washer to be used. This raises questions. So, as far as I know, there is no scientific data, no studies done, nothing to suggest why in Oregon we should have a lower standard than the national code in a seismic concerns, sitting on a seismic zone that we are. The BCD has had the authority for. In fact, I think Mr. Long told the task force that the BCD has had the authority to implement a lot of the changes that have been proposed and have had that authority all along through administrative rules and have sat on their hands and not done it. Oregon's a wet state. It's always been a wet state. A lot of these water issues, I believe the BCD should have been taking a proactive approach to dealing with years ago. They're charged with enforcing the code through the state. There are several statutes, and I believe I referenced some of them in my document and have others available, that allow them to enforce the code throughout the state. However, what they actually do is delegate it to local jurisdictions and then wash their hands of it. I've had it from a number of people in the the Department of Consumer Business Services and the Building Codes Division, that they don't have the authority to investigate or discipline any negligent building departments that they have granted the authority to conduct a building program to. From what I can find out, that's wrong. They do have that authority. If they are correct, they should have that authority and should certainly use it and make sure that the citizens of Oregon are being protected by the building departments that we are relying on to do just that.
Okay.
May I answer any questions?
Not at this point. I heard two questions there regarding maybe some of the modifications from the national standard being modified to maybe not having the scientific data to support maybe having something less than what's called for there. And also the last one was the enforcement delegate of when they delegate the power out. I will ask for some comment at some point in the future regarding that, and those type of questions I think are legitimate questions. There may already be history already in the record as to some of the changes that may be on the national code, model code, as to why things are changed. I know in other areas of legislation it is not uncommon for the state to modify whatever the model may be from any national level organization or governmental regulatory board to make certain that we have what is necessary or needed for what we have within the state or needs within the state. So we'll see if we can't get some of that information.
Thank you.
Alrighty, thank you. Again, is there anyone else who want to give testimony at this time? If not, I think we're going to stand down. What time do you think?
Either 10:45 or 11 o'clock to stand at ease.
Yeah, I think we're going to stand at ease, take a recess now until, I'm going to say 11. That way we'll make certain, because we have two more people who are supposed to be here between 10:45 and 11. And then as long as we have one of those individuals, we'll get going at 11. And then if they don't show up by, if the individuals aren't here by 11:15, we'll probably move for adjournment for today. So we'll stand at ease and recess till 11. Thank you. Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection back in order, and we've got some individuals who want to give public testimony. What I'm going to do is there's a couple of people here that wanted to give testimony regarding the two topics that we've been talking about today, Joyce Faltus and Stephen Kafori. Ms. Faltus, why don't you go ahead and come on up first, and Mr. Kafori will take you second, and then I'm going to come back and Mr. Ryan is here, and he's going to follow up on some other information he's provided to the chair earlier. Ms. Faltus?
Okay.
And what I need you to do is please identify yourself for the record by name and what community you live in And then if you'll go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay. My name is Joyce Valdez, and I live in Terrebonne, Oregon, okay. Crooked River Ranch.
Great.
In 2004, we sold a 23-acre ranch we had because my husband's back went and he couldn't take care of it. So we bought 6 acres and started looking for a contractor to build for us. It was really hard finding contractors. Everything is booming in Central Oregon. We wanted a relative to build our house, but he couldn't. He felt it wouldn't work because he's from the valley, and coming out to Central Oregon, he wouldn't get subs. So I went on the tour of homes, and I met somebody that seemed like a really, really nice builder. I liked the home that I met him in. We interviewed with him, and he told us things like, I'm there after your warranty expires, and you can have as much input as you want, blah, blah, blah. We ended up going with him. Everything was going well until our slab was poured, and he and my husband were standing on the property and looking at all the little holes filled with water. And my husband said, maybe you should check the slab. You know, it doesn't look like it's level. It wasn't. When the garage door was delivered and pulled down, only the center touched the slab. So he had to come back, the fellow who laid the slab, and pull it all out and redo it. I thought that was a good time for the builder to check the rest of the living area, but that didn't happen. When my tile was being laid, I watched the tile setter chip away at the slab, and I asked about it. I have emails to confirm everything I say. And the builder said, gee, you don't have to pay extra for that because he should have told us and the slab sub should have come back and corrected his work. Maybe that opportunity should have been taken to check the living area. Then I had expensive wood flooring put in my great room, dining room, kitchen, and office. Besides them cleaning it with a buffer and scraping the finish off, which isn't a big thing, we were walking on it and it would move. And if you dropped something, there were hollow areas in probably 75% of it. So I called it to the builder's attention. He told me to hire an objective wood floor inspector. I called the people who made my wood floor, and I had them send me to a company in St. Louis, and for $900 I had an objective inspector who said the floor has to come up. And I figured just for extra insurance, we got 2 more inspections. They said the floor has to come up. It's on an uneven slab. I must tell you that when we contracted with him, we told him this is a wheelchair accessible house built on a slab, which he knew from the drawings, with radiant heat in the slab. So nothing was a surprise. Well, I gave him the reports from the inspectors, and he went to an attorney, and everything stopped. I didn't want to go to an attorney. I didn't want to incur the expense. This is a retirement home.
I'm going to ask you, our meeting today was informational regarding what's happening on the consumer protection issues, and then we had a follow-up on review mm-hmm. on the Construction Contractors Board as well as the task force that's in place. What I'm hearing, and you and I have talked previously, and I know there's been a lot of correspondence, this wasn't our goal today was to try to get the reports and try to get some input as to where the contractor board is at, the building codes division or department is at, and some corrections and some modifications they're looking at making. And, okay. and as important as the construction claims task force as to what they have been accomplishing or attempting to accomplish during this interim period. What I need you to do is if you could frame your comments as to issues you think that need to be addressed that okay. haven't been addressed, not the details of okay. the actual situation. And also, I understand, it's ironic that you're here, I didn't know you were coming today, but Mr. Smith with the Construction Contractors Board just told me this morning that the issue that involved you has in fact been resolved, that there was a settlement that had been entered into.
Yep.
And so maybe if you can give me the perspective of how you felt as a as a consumer and how things worked or didn't work for you as it was with the agency.
Okay.
And also maybe some other points you may want to make as to things that might may have made it better for a consumer.
Okay. We did go through mediation. The house was finaled in May, and mediation took place in January. We were told not to live in the house, that we'd be accepting it as is. We were pleased with the mediator, but of course, during mediation, nobody accepted fault for anything. They just wanted to end it. Sadly, a week before, my husband broke out in shingles from head to toe.
Mm.
And was in pain like he'd never been before. The attorney from the other side was extremely difficult to handle, difficult to even speak with nicely. You couldn't do it. So we decided that we would settle if we could try to recoup most of our attorney fees. And we recouped about $10,000 less than our attorney fees. Since then, we've put all that back into fixing it and another $42,000, and it's still ongoing. What I'm concerned with is when county or city employees who are building inspectors come to the site, I'm not sure how they check and what they check for. But when I spoke with them afterwards and asked them why they don't check to see if something as important as a foundation or a slab isn't level or square. Oh, that's not in our job description. We don't have to do that. I think those codes or those rules or whatever they go by have to be changed. Okay. I think our taxpayer dollars are paying their salary and their continuing education. Just coming in, looking, and seeing that you have a slab isn't enough. I don't think we're getting the protection from the city, from the county, or from the state.
Okay. I appreciate your comments. I mean, what we've heard from other perspective is that the inspection does not require it to be, it has to be within a certain tolerance and such, and maybe what we need to do is make certain that whatever the application is, it actually reaches that level for that application. It's also my understanding that you did not actually file a complaint with
no,
the CCB.
No, I didn't. It got very convoluted. In retrospect, I should have, no matter what, because nothing will show up on his. And, you know, I don't hate him. That's the saddest part of it. I feel very bad because my personality is such that if you come to me and said, oh, where'd you get your tile? I'm so happy with my tile that I want to tell you. Go over to this place and get it. I like to make good decisions, and I like to tell people about them. And I hate the fact that we made such a bad mistake in choosing a builder, but I don't think he started out wanting it to end up this way. I'm sure he didn't. It's just that I think there have to be more restraints or more rules or something has to change to make them take responsibility.
Right. Well, I hope that in the future that if you have these type of problems that you will follow, at least I think the CCB approach would at least get something on the record and if there's some remedy there that you could have maybe received that you didn't receive through this other process.
And I would.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming over and giving us your testimony.
You're welcome.
All right. Mr. Kapori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. my name is Stephen Kapori. I'm representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. I understand that you're looking for just a quick rundown on what's been going on with the Construction Claims Task Force. We've attended all the meetings. One of our members is the alternate member of the task force. And so we're watching that from both sides, so to speak. And I think we're very pleased about the progress that's being made. The attitude of everybody involved has been one of cooperation. There's a lot of details, and sometimes people disagree about the details, but I think that's more a disagreement about how to make things work best kind of disagreement about details rather than how this is going to affect us negatively kind of details. I'm very encouraged about what's happening. We've also been meeting with Construction Contractors Board, and there's been a lot of discussion about what kind of information is given to homeowners before they select contractors. And we've been working with Craig and the CCB a lot about how to make that website work. And even, I noticed that you got some comment that wasn't read, but you may take time later to read it this morning from Mr. Varco about one of our members who complained about the way the CCB was, if I can quote, "I have some real concerns about opening up the entire record of inquiries and complaints to the public." Her concerns have been resolved. I don't think there's anybody now in our membership that is not very happy with the results of the kinds of information and that the CCB is giving out about our about people who are licensed and the way that information is. And in fact, they've gone past that and they're producing brochures. I hope you've had a chance to see those about before you hire a contractor, please do this. And it's not just, you know, two or three pages. It's a long thing. Hiring a contractor to fix your house or to build a house is not something that ought to be taken lightly. Ms. Mann is quoted here by the person who testified this morning. He says a lot of consumers are lazy. I think Ms. Mann obviously talks a little more harshly than she should, a little more. I would like to make this kind of soften her comment and say a lot of consumers don't take the time that they really need to do the thorough investigation. And I think what she's referring to here is that a lot of consumers, when they're looking at wanting to get a home, they're so excited about getting a house built or getting a house remodeled that they don't do the due diligence. A lot of our folks say we'll give people references and the consumers don't follow up on the references. A lot of them don't ask for references. We have a very detailed explanation of how a person ought to be looking for a contractor, the steps they ought to go through. It's not an easy process. It's not a simple process. But the danger is if you don't do that, you may run into trouble. And there's only so much we can do. I think we as an industry and the Construction Contractors Board and the Construction Claims Task Force are doing everything we can to make sure that the state is living up to its responsibility and the industry is living up to its responsibility. So I'm optimistic that we'll do what we can, and we also are doing a lot of outreach to the public about what their obligations are and what their opportunities are. We found a fascinating number to me that only one-third of Oregon consumers have even heard of the Construction Contractors Board, which says to me that we need to do a different kind of outreach than we've been doing in the past to get to folks so that they know that there is an agency out there that is looking out for them so that they know what to do before they go hire a contractor, and they know what to do if they have difficulties with a contractor.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pleasure to be with you today. I'm going to get a couple things out that I'll be referring to during my remarks, which will be brief. And I'm sorry if my late arrival delayed anything this morning. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about transportation issues in Washington State, but I guess there's probably no point in that. We need another freeway. That's all I'm saying. My name is Kenton Bryan, and I'm the Northwest Regional Manager for the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. We're a trade association of about 1,000 member insurance companies. We focus largely on personal lines, home, and auto insurance, but we also have commercial writers. Some of the leading writers in the country are among our members, and we have a few members who are domiciled in Oregon, including Oregon Mutual Insurance. I'm pleased to be here today to speak to you about the identity theft protection legislation that I know that there's strong interest in the Oregon legislature and also in the administration. There are basically two issues at play here, and I'd like to kind of try to discuss them separately because it can get confusing, at least from the insurance perspective, which provisions in each of these two kinds of concepts that we're for and which ones we're more cautious about. Basically, what many states are looking at are two different approaches to protecting people, consumers, from identity theft. One is security breach notification. When there is a breach of security at a major entity that collects consumer data, and consumer data is therefore exposed to unauthorized use, or the potential for that exists, There are laws across the country now to require those entities to notify the consumers whose data has been exposed. And our research indicates that about 28 states so far have passed security breach notification legislation, and rapidly, because 2 years ago, no states. I think California was the first state in 2003, but previous to that, there had been no legislation enacted. And since then, particularly in 2005, it's become very active. And as a result, as I said, we have about 28 states now that have passed that legislation. And then on the other side is what's called credit freeze or security freeze or file freeze legislation, which allows a consumer to freeze access, to restrict access or shut off access to their credit reports if they're concerned about unauthorized access to their credit. In some states, this legislation, for example, in Washington, a person may only place a file freeze on their credit report if they are a victim of identity theft. There was legislation offered in Washington this year to remove that restriction, but it got strangely political between the Attorney General and the legislature, and it all crashed in the session's final days. However, what I can tell you about the progress of file freeze legislation is that in 2004 and 2005, 11 states enacted legislation on credit freeze. And in 2006, 5 additional states enacted legislation on credit freeze. And the interesting thing from that's particular to the insurance perspective, and I think it's probably a good time for me to add in my disclaimer here that I can't speak to what, you know, ChoicePoint thinks or the Credit Data Industry Association or any of the entities that collect data have to say about these bills. And I hope as the legislature goes forward, there'll be, you know, other stakeholders besides insurers who are a party to the discussions, because they have concerns that go beyond what ours may be. So when I speak today, I want to make clear that I'm only speaking on behalf of insurance-related concerns. But in the 11 states that passed credit freeze legislation in 2004 and 2005, the bulk of those coming in 2005, 3 of those states included language and provisions to exempt insurers from the provisions of a credit freeze. In other words, insurers could continue to access frozen credit files. The reason for that is insurers made it known to policymakers that, you know, I guess anybody can get up in front of the legislature and say we're a little bit different, because everybody is a little bit different. But in the case of insurance, we don't see cases where identity thieves steal people's credit information in order to make insurance purchases. We're also not typically collectors of data. We don't keep the information. We do look at credit reports as well as Department of Motor Vehicle records and other things in order to determine someone's eligibility for insurance and their what rate they should receive, what risk they present. However, we don't keep the data, we don't use the data, we don't sell the data, and so we are a slightly different kind of entity than, say, credit bureaus and other entities that collect the data. So for this reason, we have sought in every state that has enacted legislation or considered legislation an exemption from those provisions. And as I said, in 3 of the initial 11 states, we did get those exemptions. I believe that was Colorado, North Carolina, and Texas. But in 2006, 5 additional states passed credit freeze legislation, and we were able to get exemptions in all 5 of those states. I believe that's an indication that policymakers are seeing the merit of that argument and are excluding insurers from the file freeze provisions. And we're not hearing concern expressed by consumers that that's a problem. So for that reason, I'll move to a quick discussion. Let me first, though, refer to the documents that I brought with me, which I provided to you, and I'll let you know that these are available electronically. If you'd like me to email them to the committee, I can do that for your own use in distributing them to committee members, et cetera. I brought this document. I didn't put the cover on this, but this is security breach legislation proposed and enacted as of May 1st. This document was produced by the Property Casualty Insurers Association and is a pretty solid compendium of what legislation has been enacted and where, or proposed and where, and what the status of that legislation is. And that's where I got the figure of 28 states having enacted legislation. And it will tell you, for example, exactly what's been proposed and how, you know, what changes have been proposed since then, et cetera. I also brought file freeze bill activity as of March of 2006. And this again shows where legislation has been proposed, basically what it included, and its status as of the end of March. And then also, for your reference, I brought two model bills, which represent, I think, the best example of what insurers are concerned about when we see legislation proposed in these areas. And I think that's the best way for me to describe to you is by just simply describing a little bit from the insurance perspective what these bills do and don't do. And I would like to begin with the security breach notification legislation. So do you have this? This is the Utah Senate Bill 69, 2006 General Session. This is a bill that in 2005 legislation was considered by the Utah legislature, and the sponsoring senator, Senator Walker, brought a bill in, presented it to stakeholders, got a great deal of feedback, and I think perhaps tried a little too hard to be accommodating, because she quickly found that she had exemptions for just about everybody in the bill, and she had to pull back and say, you know, what does this bill do? So she ended up dropping it last session, and over the interim worked with the Attorney General's office and stakeholder groups, including banks, Choice Point, CDIA, Credit Data Industry Association, the credit bureaus, and insurers, to develop a new piece of legislation, and in fact two, because she also sponsored a security breach notification bill. But I'm not going to confuse the two issues. I'm sorry, she also sponsored a credit freeze bill. So in the security breach notification bill, the key provisions in this legislation from PCI's perspective are: notification provisions are triggered by a likelihood that exposed information will be misused, as determined by a reasonable and prompt investigation by the entity that has suffered the exposure. Basically, the sense here is that, at least in the state of Utah, they felt that there ought to be a good likelihood that the exposure is a threatening exposure. It isn't somebody lost a disk, it's probably still in the building somewhere, then we'll find it. They need to investigate first and see how serious the breach is and what the likelihood is that it's been exposed to someone who could do something with it that's damaging, dangerous. I guess I should at this point take a step back too and just say, from the insurer's perspective, and I think you'll find this with a lot of the impacted groups, what we're looking for is not so much how can we limit or restrict this, but how can we make it as uniform as possible from state to state. So to the extent that these are our concerns that were addressed in Utah, we're interested in seeing them addressed elsewhere, mostly for the purpose of being able to write in all these states without having to have a different set of standards in every state where we do business. And I think that you'll find that that's the case for the other entities that will eventually come before you on this issue as well. Another provision that we appreciated in this legislation was that notice must be sent without unreasonable delay. I put that in quotes because that's kind of a standard that we like to see. It should be not so arbitrary so as to be easily interpreted in different ways depending on, you know, who the insurance commissioner is that year, or, you know, who's in power in the legislature, or, you know, who's presiding in a specific court. It should be fair. If there's a uniform sort of standard to what without unreasonable delay means, that's better than other more arbitrary standards. So we appreciate that standard was included in this legislation. Also, it makes clear that businesses need to determine the extent of the breach, and then they have to stop the leak, and that's all sort of preceding the efforts to make notification to consumers. And this is intended to allow them time to find out exactly what's happened and how bad it is before they notify consumers and scare them out of their wits. The third provision allows entities to determine what must be included in the notice. And by this, I mean that they didn't say one way or the other, and so that's left to the businesses who it is assumed would know best who needs to be included in the notice, what needs to be included in the notice, what consumers should know, and who they should contact if they have questions about it. It specifically states that no private right of action is created by the legislation, and I've cited the reference here in the statute. It's our belief that enforcement and penalties ought to be left to law enforcement authorities, to the Attorney General's office, and should not spawn the ability to have multiple lawsuits filed when there is a breach of security. This is a little touchy, kind of a touchy thing to suggest, but I think in most cases where these things occur, there may be negligence involved, but oftentimes the businesses that have suffered the breach are also victims of the breach. There's an unauthorized access. They didn't do it on purpose. They've been victimized as well. It shouldn't result in, unless they have done something willful, or even in cases where there's negligence, there should be enforcement action allowed, but not a private right of action, in our view. Additionally, PCI does not support requiring notification to consumer reporting agencies. That's not included in this bill, but sometimes it is. We feel that that's a benefit for the consumer reporting agencies, but does not provide specific benefit to the consumer. And there, it's just another step, and a costly one to have to follow. So from our perspective, those are the things that we look for in security breach bills. From our perspective, the Utah bill is the best statute in the nation, and it was just enacted. Prior to that, the other legislation that we typically point to is California and Delaware, for being two of the better bills. So if you're looking about for examples, at least from I think that you'll find the smoothest road to having, well, I should say a good starting point is to look at those states from our perspective, and I'm pretty sure that others in the financial services industry and credit industry would agree. Now, moving to the credit freeze legislation, I have with me I would call it a model bill. I'm fairly certain that this came to PCI didn't create this document, but we did alter it to include our concerns. This may have come from the credit bureau industry, but I couldn't say that with certainty, and so I've not put their name on it, but my understanding is that they're okay with this language. Again, a credit freeze, of course, is a tool that consumers can use to restrict access to their credit information. In some states, it's only if they're already a victim of identity theft. In other states, they can do it whenever they want. The key provisions in this model bill that PCI supports are as follows. First, it allows reasonable fees, not more than $10 per freeze or per temporary or permanent lift when they want to lift their freeze. And it's the fee is not applied to any consumer who is a valid proven victim of identity theft. And by proven, I guess I just mean they file the police report and they're cooperating with an investigation, as opposed to just saying they're a victim of identity theft or believing they might be. It allows an application for credit for any other use to be treated as incomplete if a consumer makes such application while a freeze is in place and doesn't lift the freeze. In other words, you don't want to lift the freeze, we get to treat your application as incomplete. I guess I would note that this is something of a fallback kind of position. And, for example, there was a bill introduced in Alaska this session which did not pass. But one of the things, insurers were not able to get an exemption as that bill was moving forward, but one of the things that was put in was to say, here's how you can treat a consumer if they don't have, if they're not allowing access to their credit file. So you may treat them as neutral, basically, in terms of their credit, which is, you know, better than nothing from our perspective, because we have to know how we can treat someone who doesn't allow us access to their credit. Third provision allows access to frozen consumer credit reports for use in setting or adjusting a rate, adjusting a claim, or underwriting for insurance purposes. This is, of course, for our perspective, the crux of the issue for us. We would like to be able to access credit reports even when they're frozen, because we believe it's easier for consumers than having to go lift a freeze for purposes of seeking an insurance quote. And well, I'll mention that I'm going to skip down to the bottom to say there's an alternative to a flat-out exemption, which has been enacted in Utah in Senate Bill 71 and also in Texas. I didn't have the bill when I wrote this up, but both those states simply they took a different route, and they defined a credit report quite specifically for purposes of the freeze as a consumer report defined in federal statute, used or collected in whole or in part for the purpose of serving as a factor in establishing eligibility for credit. So another way to go, and this helps, I think, in other areas beyond the insurance question, because, again, in Alaska, when we discussed this issue this session, they included all state agencies in the credit freeze provision. So agencies of the government also could not access frozen credit files. There may be agencies for law enforcement purposes or other reasons that you may want to carve out, and this allows you to get around the need to carve anybody out specifically. It just says this is an this has to do with people's ability to access credit reports when they're trying to get money or buy things. And this limits it fairly well. It provides penalties for obtaining credit reports fraudulently or placing or lifting a credit freeze under false pretenses. And it provides penalties for entities found negligent in failing to comply with the statute with respect to a consumer, including actual damages, and in the event of a court action, the award of attorney's fees determined by the court. So in a nutshell, we're looking for uniformity and fairness. We're looking for a reasoned approach to consumer concerns. I think it is worth pointing out briefly that there is the FACT Act, the federal act that allows consumers the ability to limit access to their credit already, but that doesn't mean that states should not be interested in passing their own legislation that goes beyond that. We just seek the legislation be produced in a reasonable way that allows some uniformity from state to state. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. You and I have had an opportunity to speak before, so I have no additional questions. I do really appreciate you bringing the handouts that you have and keeping the committee up to date as to the perspective of your industry and also some recently passed legislation.
My pleasure. And again, if you'd like us to provide that electronically, I'd be happy to forward
it. Let staff make that decision, and if she wants it electronically for her purposes, we'll have her contact you.
Very good.
Thank you very much. So is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on the topics that we had? Mr. Varco?
Thank you, Chair Krasinski. During the break, I was wandering in the lobby and I spotted a billboard or sign there. And I'm not sure who put it there, if it's a Building Codes Division or just whom is involved in it. But it had a statement on it that caught my attention. And that statement says that if you select a licensed contractor and take out a building permit, you will be insured. It will ensure that your project meets the building code. I found that quite troubling. I got discussed with Craig Smith from the CCB. Him and I went out and looked at it, and I think it caused him enough concern that he went and had a conversation with Mr. Long about it. But that is a patently false statement to say that if we select a licensed contractor and if we take out a building permit, that our project will meet the building code. And I'm not so sure the state may even have some liability there. And I'm requesting that everything that has that statement on it should be immediately retracted and reworded in a manner. This is the type of thing that causes consumers so much trouble, is when the state is holding out and making these kind of representations to us that if you do these things, it'll be okay. Well, I know from my own experience that it may not be okay, and they should have a little bit more, appropriate wording.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. May I ask any questions?
You can. I actually saw the display, but I didn't stop to look at it during the break, so I'll make a point to walk out there and look at it.
Thank you.
If there's no one else that has who wants to have an opportunity to give testimony today, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn us for today, and we'll stand adjourned.